I open the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor for February 27, 2013. The order that we're going to be doing today is a little out of order. We're going to open and close House Bill 2646. So Representative Hoyle, where'd she go? So Representative Hoyle could speak on that one, and then we're going to open up the public hearing, and we're going to hear the two bills together of 2675 and 2677, and then we will end with 2545 and end the entire meeting with a work session. Okay. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2646. Jan, if you could
Madam Chair, committee members,
give us a summary.
This bill applies the provisions of the prevailing wage law to agreements in which a private entity constructs, reconstructs, paints, or renovates any improvement on real property that the Oregon University System owns or will use, occupy, or ultimately own. And there are no amendments before you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hoyle?
Val Hoyle, I represent House 14, West Eugene and Junction City, and thank you very much for having me here this morning. I think my comments would apply equally to House Bill 2646, 2675, or 2677. I think this is good public policy. I believe prevailing wage is good public policy. When we pay people a decent living wage, that is money that gets invested back into our community. The fact of the matter is that these bills are trying to close loopholes in the current system, by ensuring that we can pay prevailing wage, whether it be with our Oregon University system, within enterprise zones, or in areas where public monies are invested, it ensures that we can protect against out-of-state contractors who can undercut local area wages by employing low-skill, low-wage workers. We can invest our tax dollars employing Oregon workers who spend their money on goods and services back in our communities and pay taxes that pay for our schools. And we can stimulate the local economy and increase income tax revenue. I don't really have a lot to say other than I'm extremely supportive of these bills. I think it's sound public policy, and I think it's a good investment of our public dollars. And if we're paying public dollars, then we should be ensuring that we are paying prevailing wage and, again, allowing those monies to be spent on goods and services right here in Oregon.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Any questions of Representative Hoyle? Thank you very much for testifying. Looking at the three bills and all of the people that have signed up, and a lot of the testimony will be similar, is that I think what we're going to do is continue with 2646. We have a panel of three, four, five, six, seven people signed up for that one, and then we have quite a few for the other two. So we're going to continue on with 2646, and then after that we will combine the other two bills and have public hearing on that. So for 2646, we have John Molis, Nathan Phillips,
Brian Krieg.
And Brian Krieg.
Thank you. You never know. That's right.
Thank you, gentlemen. If you make sure you say your name for the record.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. Here to testify in favor of House Bill 2646. We believe it's a fairly simple concept. If there's a building that's built on publicly owned land, university owned land, and built for the use of the students or the public that's going to use the property, we believe that prevailing wage for the workers that build the project should apply. In all honesty, we thought that's where the guardrails already were, and in conversations with a lot of folks, including a lot of legislators, they've agreed with us. We view this as just a loophole that needs to be closed. We're not opposed to donors helping fund projects on our university campuses. We're not opposed to public-private partnerships. In fact, we're in favor of those. I'll be testifying this afternoon in favor of the governor's and treasurer's West Coast infrastructure project, as long as prevailing wage applies. So as these new public-private partnerships and new public contracting methods come on board, we want to be supportive of them as long as they're not eliminating or dodging paying prevailing wage to the workers that build the projects. In fact, a lot of our local pension funds and national pension funds are looking to invest in infrastructure projects. We realize that's a market that's vastly undercapitalized. The needs are great, and if we can help fund some of these projects and move them forward and put our people to work, we're happy to do that. So again, in closing, we just feel very strongly that if a project is built on university-owned land and it's for the use of those students or faculty or athletes, we believe prevailing wage should apply. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next.
Thank you, Representative Daugherty. My name is Nathan Phillips, and I'm an electrical contractor in Eugene, and I'm here representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. I'm an employer who pays family wages. We provide full benefits, a health insurance pension plan, and this is the benefit of prevailing wage. It creates a level playing field for us to compete and continue to provide those benefits to our employees. The Oregon University System projects in my community that have been built on with these creative leasing and other arrangements have resulted in skirting the prevailing wage requirements for these public projects that are making use of public bonding and are owned and maintained by public owners after they're completed. And we think that that's unfair. And in order to support the community and with good wages, training, benefits, all the things that we do, we'd like to see all of those public jobs be subject to prevailing wage.
Thank you very much. Ms. Green?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg. Today I'm here representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, and the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. My two colleagues here at the panel have actually stated everything I was going to say. It is a really important issue to close this loophole so that what we believe everyone was intending is actually done. It's really important for our contractors to be able to get work that will help them to provide the benefits and the salaries for all their employees. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions of the panelists? Mr. Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, would you be against donated labor? And the reason I bring this up, we had an instance in Yamhill County where YCAP had received a lot of money for energy efficiency for low-income housing. They had volunteers willing to go out and put these windows in, do the things to bring the houses up to code, but it was tied to Davis-Bacon. So instead of being able to use volunteer labor or local guys that they could pay $12, $15 an hour to go out and do it, they had to do prevailing wage with the Davis-Bacon, and that's the only way they could use. So rather than doing 50 homes, they were only able to do 15 homes. So if somebody wanted to donate to the school and use donated labor to install it, would you be okay with that? Because you're tying the hands of some of these people making donations by saying they must pay prevailing wage.
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, I can't speak to the specifics of that project, obviously, because this is the first I've heard about it, and I don't know the
not that specific project.
But having said that, I come out of the Bricklayers Union. Our union's apprenticeship program has built numerous dugouts at public schools all over the state on a volunteer basis. We get the materials donated by the material suppliers. Our contractors help us out with equipment, and we go out and build the dugouts on school property with volunteer labor. So that's not a concept that we're trying to stop.
Any other questions? Mr. Thompson?
How would this apply to university foundations as a separate entity? And to give you an example, I'm thinking of Western Oregon University owns a Victorian home under their foundation that's used for meetings and gatherings and whatnot, weddings. And it's governed by a foundation board of directors and largely maintained by volunteers that make up the volunteer organization in this foundation. Would that apply?
Chair Doherty, Representative Thompson, in all honesty, I'm not familiar enough with how foundations work or how they're tied to the universities, so I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if either of my panelists will. With the chair's permission, maybe I can research that question and get the answer back to you.
Thank you very much. Is that acceptable?
That's acceptable, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? Hey, thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
The next panel is Drew Hagendorn, Ryan Hagman, and Hillary Bounds, Boards.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, committee members. My name is Drew Hagedorn. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon University System. I'm joined by Hillary Bounds, Director of Contracting and Purchasing for OUS, as well as Ryan Hageman, OUS's General Counsel. They're here to answer any questions that you have about technical aspects of the bill and probably can respond to Representative Thompson's question. We are here testifying today as neutral on this bill with the caveat that we would like to see an amendment to the legislation that will more narrowly tailor the concept to avoid any unintended consequences while still achieving the policy objectives that we understand the proponents are after. We met with the building trades by way of background to discuss this issue. We heard from them that they had two policy components that they wanted to achieve. The first was to apply prevailing wage rates as a mandate in these instances that were described previously, in addition to certify those payrolls as a second step. We're fine with that concept. Again, we just want to make sure that we are narrowly tailoring it so we don't have any unintended consequences. I'll turn now, with your leave, Madam Chair, to General Counsel Hageman, who can answer Representative Thompson's questions and also talk about our amendment concept.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Hageman, and I am the Oregon University System's General Counsel. And to echo what Mr. Hagedorn said, that's exactly the process we're in, and the review of amendments and trying to kind of narrowly tailor those to achieve those objectives after Drew and Hillary met with the building trades. That's kind of my job. Mm-hmm. One component of that, to Representative Thompson's question, that was one of the issues that popped into my mind, because the bold language in House Bill 2646 now talks about a private entity. My first read under law would be that a foundation, which is a separate 501c3 organization recognized by the federal government for the benefit of those institutions, would indeed be a private entity. And so what we're trying to do is achieve the policy objectives that emerged from the meeting while narrowly tailoring the language so we don't have any of those unintended consequences hampering a foundation or tying the hands of a donor who would like to give money to build a building or do something on university property. But as Drew said, we're not in opposition to the concept. We want to just fine-tune the amendment.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I may, we have submitted the drafting request for that amendment. It's not back from Legislative Council. We'll obviously provide that to the committee and the proponents as soon as we have that in hand. But we'd ask that, at least for today, that we not proceed with a work session on this bill.
Okay, because I was going to ask you whether you've gotten together with the other workers on the bill for amendments, because that's what we want to do. Any questions? Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi.
Are you here?
Yeah. Yes, Chair Doherty. I'm the Director of Contracting and Purchasing for the Oregon University System, and I oversee our policy around capital construction.
Identify yourself,
please. Oh, I'm Hillary Bounds. I'm sorry. I'm Hillary Bounds, the Director of Contracting and Purchasing, and I just wanted to speak about our current practices, which are that the board mandates two projects, whether public, private, or leasebacks, that we do institute a prevailing wage policy and that the contractors follow prevailing wage. When we met with the building trades, they did indicate that they would prefer an additional step of requiring certified payroll, which is something we're open to, and we express that we're open to adding to our administrative rules so that that's the second step and the prevailing wage can be verified as being paid.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. Thank you. Any other any questions of the panel? Representative Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we have you in your contracting, I'm just kind of curious, what do you think this is going to do cost per job, prevailing wage versus non-prevailing wage for some of the projects that you do? Is it going to be an increase in 20%, 10%, 30%?
It's actually, the numbers that we have received is about 27.5% an increase when you're paying prevailing wage. However, we do pay the prevailing wage, so we don't feel that as the bill would be amended, it would have a fiscal impact. That way we are sure that it applies only to the situations that meet the needs of what the people who have proposed the bill want. For other situations, you know, that is just the difference as proposed to us and provided to us by, you know, our fiscal office that it is about a 27.5%. But for the projects that we have contemplated and have completed, we already pay the prevailing wage.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mr. Witt, and then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hillary, that 27.5% increase that you cited is 27.5% increase in what?
It's in the labor costs versus if you're, you have something that doesn't require a prevailing wage. And that's definitely an estimate and not something that I personally researched but was provided to me by our staff. I could provide more detail about where that came from, but we didn't look into it too closely because we do pay the prevailing wage on all projects.
Madam Chair.
Please.
And I understand you, these are not figures perhaps that you're intimately familiar with, but I would be interested in knowing a 27.5% increase in labor costs. Is that hourly labor costs? Would that be project labor costs?
Hourly. Hourly. Is my understanding. Yeah. I could be
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a comment that an hourly labor costs may not determine what the total project costs are and likely do not. So.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Okay, Representative Matthews, and then Representative Ruby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard the phrase several times that we do pay prevailing wage, and I have a feeling we wouldn't be here if that was the case every time. And I'm just kind of curious if it's maybe that the university system, when you sponsor a project, you do, but in cases where somebody's donating a project, they don't. Is that why we're here today?
Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, our understanding is that obviously when it's a purely public project, that the OUS is the GC constructing the project. That's not really why we're here today. We pay prevailing wage rates on those. We're talking about the isolated instance where there is some making of availability of a public land, a university property, to a donor, and then that donor constructs what otherwise is a perfectly private project on that facility, and then gives it back or otherwise makes it available to the institution. So that's the narrow instance that we're talking about here. And as a general rule, our understanding is that the Board of Higher Education has required payment of prevailing wage in those instances. The second step in the process, which is certifying those payrolls as having been paid at the prevailing wage rate, we have not required that. And so I think part of what the objective is here is to make sure that we're requiring that so that we can remove any ambiguity that the prevailing wage rates were paid or not.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate that everybody's working together to get to that because I think that's probably the original intent. And I think that's good for the public. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Holby, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Most of my question was answered between these two other colleagues up here, but I just wanted to go back to the 27% because that number is pretty elusive, and I want to make sure that specifically we're finding out that it's 27% above what, because the prevailing wage rate is an average of the industry, generally determined by BOLI, and you know that can be debated through their surveys and all that, but at the end of the day, that's what it's defined as. So I'm curious: is it 27% above minimum wage, or is it 27% above some sort of industry standard? That I'm really kind of curious where that wage or that figure came from, because it's sort of confusing. And I considering that generally labor costs are 27 or only 20% of the project, it really seems sort of a very large number to me. And to follow up on Representative Matthews' question, and I think Mr. Hagedorn somewhat addressed it, I was just curious about the amendments, how they address the specific instance where the university is leasing the land to a donor, and then the donor is constructing and then gifting back to the university. And that whole concept has always been sort of, seems like sort of a backdoor way for something, and I'm not sure what. And, for me, I want to be clear that the amendment is speaking that, and I know that you're probably aware of a different bill that requires compliance to the public contracting code in general, not just prevailing wage, but all the code. As to when you're doing that process, I mean, the definition in the past has always been if it's on a public agency's property that they own. I mean, that asset that's being built is an asset that ultimately will belong to the university system. And so, you know, it is, I mean, it seems like that should be the defining, one of the defining measures. Is it on university property? If it is, it seems like, you know, all these other, you know, I guess, arrangements through leasing and gifts and things are, you know, trying to get around something, and I'm not sure what they're trying to get around. So I'm just curious how your amendment is going to address that specific practice.
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, I'll answer your first question on the 27.5%. I think the best practice for us here would probably to prepare a memorandum kind of outlining what the data, whether it was used, so we can kind of clearly articulate what the question is, and then make that available to the committee. So on that one, and I'll let Mr. Hageman discuss your second question.
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, I think what the amendment will do is kind of spell out the situation. I mean, be very specific as to the types of scenarios, playing off of the exceptions to the definition of public work, putting something back in a certain transaction that would nonetheless be characterized as a public work. So that's what we're working, is looking at these transactions, like Drew has mentioned, where it is university property, but is licensed or leased back to a private entity to build a building to their specifications, to the donor's intent, and then get them back to the institution. So that's what the amendment will do, is we'll spell out those types of transactions will be put back into the definition of public work, which would be subject to prevailing wage.
Thank you for clearing that up for me.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, is there any concern with possibly losing some donations by this, where private entities are donating for these projects, of possibly losing those with this bill going into effect, knowing that their dollar is not going to go as far, just because I know guys who donate money, they want to get the biggest bang for their buck, and they might go elsewhere?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, it's possible. I think that the countervailing argument to that would be on projects of this narrow scope that the Board of Education has entertained in the past, we have paid prevailing wage, and it's been a requirement of the contracts. And so there are not very common situations, but it's always possible that express restrictions you put on this type of transaction, someone might say no, but the Board of Higher Education, in the two transactions with which I have been involved as the board's attorney, we have required prevailing wage in those situations.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you for one more question, because it was something I forgot to address. Currently under the bill, it's addressing the Oregon University system. So I'm curious for the attorney, are we going to be able to have an amendment that defines the Oregon University system to also include subsequent independent universities that are not part of the OUS system?
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, that's above my pay grade. I think that, I mean, we're going to have to follow those amendments and anything that happens in university governance. And if this body and this legislature wants to do that, that's, I mean, there's going to be a lot of reconciliation in months to come, and that's one of many. So right now, the definition of the Oregon University system is the Office of the Chancellor, the State Board of Higher Education, and the seven public universities listed at ORS 352-002.
Okay. Hey, any other questions? Thank you very much for your information. We also do have testimony submitted from Jamie Moffitt, who's the Vice President for Finance and Administration and the CFO at University of Oregon, and from Len Norwitz, SEIU, in support. Ms. Moffitt's just went through and explained what the prevailing wage was at the University of Oregon system. Okay, anybody else on this issue? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2545 and open the...
We were on 2646.
Oh, excuse me.
2646.
You said 2545. Okay. I close the hearing on 2646. Okay. And on this one, particular one, we're waiting for a fiscal impact statement on this issue, so we're going to carry the work session on this bill over to the next agenda. Okay. I'd also like to open up a public hearing on both House Bill 2675 and House Bill 2677. And a lot of the people that are signed up for both bills, you can just do your testimony for both bills at the same time, and then we'll call up the people that are just signed up on one of the issues. So the first people we'll call up are John Molas, Nathan Phillips, and you too. And Rick Metzger. Thank you. Nice seeing you again.
Nice to be here. Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. So just if I clarify your instructions or understand them correctly, you'd like me to testify on one bill, stop, and then on the second one?
Or well, what it is, all of us? There were a lot of people that since the issues are so similar,
right,
that they wanted the testimony to be done together. So you have your choice. You could either do both at one time or you do on one, and then we'll call you back up for the other. But we're doing both of the bills at the same time.
Okay.
So it's whatever you feel most comfortable doing.
It doesn't matter to me, whatever you'd like me to do. It doesn't matter a bit.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Molas with the Oregon Building Trades Council. I'll start with House Bill 2675, which would require payment of prevailing wage for projects inside economic enterprise zones that are valued at more than $5 million.
Ms. Molas, if I could stop you. Jan, could you please give us a summary of both of the bills?
Well, he was doing a wonderful job.
And then you were doing such a great job, we didn't want to do super duty.
Madam Chair, committee members.
Super duty.
House Bill 2675 modifies the definition of a public works for the purpose of applying the prevailing wage rate, and it includes private projects exceeding $5 million in costs located in enterprise zones and receiving a property tax exemption. Also modifies the definition of the funds of a public agency to include exemptions from property taxation allowed for projects in the enterprise zone. And House Bill 2677, very similar, defines funds of a public agency for the purposes of applying the prevailing wage rate to include tax credit or tax abatement that the contractor receives in connection with the project. And it adds a definition to public works to include a private project exceeding $5 million in a enterprise zone receiving a property tax exemption.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Mr. Molas. Should we continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Molas with the Oregon Building Trades Council. So I think everyone in this room, whether they're in favor of this bill or opposed, would agree that the intent of economic enterprise zones is to create jobs for Oregonians, to provide economic development in the communities in which the economic enterprise zones are located. I did a little research, and the language from ORS 285C that excludes construction workers, it's number 7, and it says, an employee means a person who works more than 32 hours a week but does not include a person with a temporary or seasonal job or a person hired solely to construct the qualified property. And I don't know why that was written in all honesty. I haven't had the time to go back and research what the intent was. It's a little frustrating. We have a very well-trained, well-qualified construction workforce in this state, and it's a very important part of our state's economy. And many times when you have opponents of projects, they'll say, oh, well, those jobs will only create temporary construction jobs, which is always very frustrating to us because in the construction industry, we understand that all construction jobs are temporary, whether they last for 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months. That's the whole intent, is to complete the job safely and efficiently and move on to the next one. So we feel that adding prevailing wage to these projects that are in excess of $5 million would benefit Oregon's construction contractors, Oregon's construction workforce, and the Main Street businesses in those communities where the workers and contractors spend their money. Personally, our council supports economic enterprise zones. Personally, I do as well. One of the volunteer hats that I wear is I'm a commissioner for the Portland Development Commission. We have economic enterprise zones that we help administer. I believe firmly in them. Our council and I personally, we believe in these. We're pro-economic development. We're pro-jobs. We just believe that this is a loophole, again, that needs to be closed. So thanks very much for your time. If there's questions, I'll do my best to answer them. And I can either turn it over to somebody else or I can go into the other bill, whatever the chair.
Just go ahead and go into the other bill.
Thank you. I'll speak now to House Bill 2677. So under current law, if there's $750,000 of state or public money that's invested with a private developer in constructing a project, then prevailing wage applies. The one place where that does not apply is in the case of tax credits. And over the past several years, we've seen some pretty good-sized tax credits go out the door to finance projects, especially Betsy tax credits, some of them up to $11 million, where prevailing wage didn't apply on the projects that they helped incentivize and helped fund. And so, again, we just believe this is a loophole that needs to be closed. If there's those kind of public dollars that are going out the door to incent development, then prevailing wage is good public policy, which will help promote the use of local contractors, local workers, who once again take their paychecks, cash them, and spend them in the communities that they live and work in. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next.
Chairman Daugherty and members of the committee, my name is Nathan Phillips. I'm an electrical contractor in Eugene and represent NECA today. I'm going to just speak to both these bills at the same time because I think they're sort of fundamentally the same issue, which is, in my view, there's really no fundamental difference between a tax expenditure, whether it's a tax credit or a tax abatement, and a general fund subsidy or other ways of funding these projects. These projects that receive tax expenditures to promote economic development, not only through new facilities, but they also generate broader public benefits that result from the work of prevailing wage on construction of the development. Our workers don't end up on the Oregon Health Plan and food stamps, and they require with an adequate pension or retirement plan. The prevailing wage on these projects levels the playing field, which creates long-term benefits for all Oregonians because of these reduced costs. Also, if we build a development, we get the opportunity to demonstrate that our capabilities, and we earn the opportunity to provide the ongoing maintenance and changes that occur in these facilities over the life of them, of the facilities. This creates an ongoing opportunity for us to continue to support our communities by paying a living wage with full benefits. I'd also like to speak to the relative costs of prevailing wage projects and non-prevailing wage projects. It's been well demonstrated that total project costs include both the cost of construction and the cost of ownership. And there are many, many studies that demonstrate that the lowest initial cost does not result in the lowest cost of ownership. By the time you fix all the things that happen during construction and maintain the facility over its life, that's when you really know whether or not that low bid saved you money or not. We are a company that pays prevailing wage on all work, and we compete on a daily basis on private work that does not require, that's not subject to prevailing wage. If our costs were truly 27% higher than the competition that does not pay a family wage with full benefits, we wouldn't be successful on these projects, and most of the work that we do is private work. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Metzger?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Rick Metzger, and I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Council of Carpenters and the Construction Alliance, which is a labor federation consisting of the carpenters as well as the International Union of Operating Engineers. And we're in support of all three of the bills, the two before you and the one you just heard. And again, you only need to see my face once. So I want to echo that prevailing wage is a critical part of the public investment, whether that be through, as was mentioned before, a tax subsidy in lieu of taxes are collected or those that have been collected and put back. That public infrastructure or public investment requires that we have best public policy that follow those dollars. It's designed to prevent the public sector's large expenditures and strict competitive bidding requirements from destabilizing local and regional construction markets. By taking wages out of the equation, prevailing wages organize competition around quality, productivity, and efficiency without touching off a race to the bottom for people in your community. By lowering the rate of pay that's earned by their workers and, as I mentioned before, the cost of ownership that happens inevitably in the years that follow. The goal is that with everyone playing on that same playing field, the contractors will seek to maximize the productivity of their workers and their own ability to manage their project better than their competition. It's public policy, and if we're using public dollars of all we should stand up to make sure that those public dollars follow the public policy that has been established by the legislature. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of the panelists? Representative Kenemer?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Mr. Phillips, I wanted to go back to your comment. If I understood correctly, your business pays prevailing wage regardless of the nature of the job to your employees. And I wondered if that is true, and also then how common is that among NECA members?
Through the chair, Representative Kenemer, yes, we pay the prevailing wage on all jobs. We're signatory to the agreement with the IBEW, and our wage rate is the prevailing wage. Mm-hmm. And that's true for all NECA contractors.
Okay, fine, thank you. Representative Thatcher.
I had a question. Sorry. See if I can get this over the mic. Okay, so public contracting law, would that apply also where certain parameters around letting a project go for bid and the public notices and all that stuff, would that also apply to these projects? That prevailing wage would apply?
I don't know that.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I believe that once the prevailing wage law kicks in and applies, then yes, then that would apply to those projects.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Widener?
I understand.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you also want to jump the gun there?
I think that what these bills do is they define these projects as public works, which then wraps them into the public works statutes, so they would be subject to competitive bidding and all of the other public works rules.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You hit on something that kind of perked my ear a little bit because you said cost of ownership over the project. So you're saying people that don't pay prevailing wage are not building things to code or to the spec that it's designed? Is that what I'm understanding? So rather than an 8-inch wall, they'll pour a 6-inch wall, or use, rather than 2x6s, 2x4s?
Well, I'll comment on that. I think the concept is primarily that if you have a public asset, and I think in our private lives, if you had a private asset, you want to ensure that it is built well, that it is built safely, and that you use the best skilled workforce available to ensure the quality of that project. And this is part of that equation that helps do that. I think when you look at some of the numbers that were thrown around earlier today, and they're always fascinating because, and you've dissected a few of those already through some of your questions in terms of what the absolute cost is, but you have to look at the cost not only of building that project, but with the assurity and the accountability you're giving that public that is going to be an asset that will be durable.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Following up on my previous question, most projects that everybody kind of recognizes as public works projects usually have a bureaucracy that's overseeing them, and they're deemed the owner of the project. How would it be in an E-zone where it is a private company coming in? Who would be overseeing and making sure and policing the application of the public contracting law, the public works laws to that project?
Representative Thatcher, through the chair, I know that I've been a subcontractor on numerous HUD projects that are subject to federal prevailing wage that don't have a public owner per se. They have a private owner that's receiving public funds, federal funds, and in that case, the private owner acts as the project manager, and they're required to collect all the certified payroll reports, and they act as the bureaucracy, as on any private work. So the owner takes that role.
Follow up, but it's a HUD project, so somebody at HUD is probably overseeing this, right?
Well, just as in through the chair, just as in state prevailing wage jobs, the certified payroll reports are required, and they are reviewed by the agency at the state on a random basis. I think at federal level, I think they're pretty consistent about reviewing them all the time.
Well, follow up. I guess so. I'm wondering who would be the person following up and inspecting that these certified payroll reports, et cetera, are being properly filled out and that the wages are being paid. Who would be doing that? Would it be Boley? Who would it be?
Through the chair, I believe it would be Boley. That's a whole other subject. The level of compliance in that area is not great, and there's not a lot of enforcement. So it falls on private industry in many cases to provide the enforcement.
Okay. That'd be interesting. Interesting enforcement. I think it'd be kind of interesting.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, the next panel we have, and they were signed up on for both bills, was Carl Harbaugh and Byron Hendricks.
Sure.
Yeah, my name is Carl Harbaugh. I own a company called Southtown Glass here in Salem. I'm a union shop and have been a union shop for about 3 years. I previously was a non-union shop and worked in this area and worked in general contracting in this same market of work. And I'm opposed to this, and I shouldn't be, because my business thrives on prevailing wage work, and the union employees do as well. But it's not right. The competition that we have out there with non-union people, which are who I used to be and who I have to compete against now, keeps an even playing field. We have to go to the union and ask for money back from them to try to compete with those non-union companies that can come in and do work. And it the prevailing wage thing, and extending it further, makes that workforce much weaker and much less likely that they'll succeed and create competition for the unions. It's like you're setting a wage rate. You're talking about the percentages of differences. It's huge. It's getting work or not getting work. I don't know how. I right now, I have to pay all of my people. I've got two different rates. I've got a residential kind of rate, and I've got the regular union scale rate. And so that allows me to be somewhat flexible in the residential side, so I can do some of this private work. But when I do that, I have to get a kickback from the union in order to be able to be competitive as I can. And currently, I can't even be competitive. I have to do an absolute perfect job. I have to have super people, and I have to shine. Because there's a lower price out there, and in this market, when we're trying to deal with the economy and people don't have money to spend, they don't care. So, I think that this is a big deal. I mean, I feel like I'm David and you're Goliath, and I'm trying to beat the system. But I think we need to take a deep look at this and say, this is not the right thing to do. We need to keep the competition there.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Dorsey, members of the committee, I'm Byron Hendricks in Salem, Oregon. I have several hats. I am chairman of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation of Marion Polk County. I am not speaking on behalf of them today, but I will share views from that my position in that role. I'm also an inactive general contractor. I've developed about 80,000 square foot office space and in the neighborhood of 400 residential lots. And I'm also in the real estate business. So my perspective on this is going to come out from those three categories. First, from an economic development standpoint, I oppose House Bill 2675 and House Bill 2677 due to the nature of economic development. We're in the process now that Oregon is fighting fiercely to try and create jobs on an ongoing basis in all the state, and specifically for Marion and Polk County. There's issues that we're disadvantaged by. We're advantaged by a number of things, including a great workforce, great quality of lifestyle, a great quality of citizen involvement in the issues like that that help us attract. But the economic development zones, whether they're enterprise zones or other incentivized zones to try and bring employers in, we currently compete certainly among 50 states, but also on an international basis to try and locate companies here that could employ many Oregonians and make a huge difference for quality of life for Oregonians. We're disadvantaged first from the standpoint that a good example is we're working with a manufacturer to locate a plant here in Salem that actually was pretty heated towards doing it, and they disappeared. And when we asked why, they said, we're focusing on right-to-work states. We aren't going to fix that, and it's one of those issues that's there. But when we provide economic incentive for someone to locate a plant here and create jobs for Oregonians, and then say, by the way, you have to increase your construction costs by probably in the neighborhood of 16% is an accurate number. My labor costs run about 30%. I met with my contractors that have done projects for me prior to coming to testify today. Currently, and I like to call it Davis-Bacon because prevailing wage is a different situation. When you look at wages across the board in construction right now, it's about $16-17 an hour if they're not under Davis-Bacon. And with Burden, that comes out to about $24. Under prevailing wages, $54. So it's a substantial increase for contractors. And when you have those labor costs as part of a project, it's one more piece that can stop development that's good for Oregon and makes a difference. As a general contractor, I'll tell you that every time I do a project, the specs are written out. The talk about inferior product coming out would only be if I chose to not exercise my judgment and make sure the bid that was provided to me called out the items that were required to be in the bid. If you bid it with 2x6 walls, it's going to have 2x6 walls if somebody's paying attention. And the maintenance on my projects that I've done and developed and held has been, they have been built with they weren't Davis-Bacon contractors. And my building on 20th Street, 30,000 square foot, 10 years old, it's been an exceptional building. I've done business with Carl. Carl has come in and met costs. People have ways to do this, but putting one more economic burden on a company that wants to create jobs in the state of Oregon, provide revenue through those jobs on every for running Oregon is a huge difference. So I oppose the bills. I think they almost wipe out the benefit of an Economic Development Act. So we fund money through tax incentives and then say, by the way, we're going to take that back in this other area. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions of the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank
Next
you.
Panel we have is John Rakowicz and Sean Miller.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Rakowicz. I'm here representing Associated General Contractors, the Oregon Columbia chapter. Most members of the committee know that we represent a very broad spectrum of commercial contractors in Oregon, union and open alike. And that's where I'd like to start and underscore. We do not view this as a issue somehow between pitting union and open shop contractors against each other. And the reason we do not is that all union and open contractors, open shop contractors, pay prevailing wages today, currently under current law, on public works. We don't have an issue with that. It's a public work, then pay prevailing wage rates. Our position is that prevailing wage rates should be required only on true public works projects. And both of these bills, House Bill 2675 and 2677, would muddy the line between public and private construction in Oregon. And essentially what it does is redefine what constitutes public works in the state of Oregon. So House Bill 2675 would do that by requiring private businesses to pay prevailing wage rates when building their own buildings on their own property in enterprise zones. The other bill would also require private businesses to pay public work prevailing wage rates when building their own buildings in the event that they have benefited from a tax abatement or credit of some kind. And that's why AGC opposes both of these bills. Finally, I want to say I suspect every single member of this committee knows acutely how hard hit Oregon's construction industry has been in recent years. There's probably not another industry that's been any harder hit than we have. Our particularly on the commercial construction side, which is the side of the industry I represent, our recovery is going to depend on private investment and in a growing economy. And that's what it's going to take for our industry to begin to recover. The impacts of these bill would be to diminish private investment in Oregon and, at a minimum, push out our industry's future recovery. And finally, I would like to say it was a very interesting question the Representative Thatcher posed. What this bill would require is any private business that is located in the Enterprise Zone or receive one form of tax abatement or another, they would have to figure out the BOLI prevailing wage book. It's about that thick. And figure out for each type of craft exactly what wage they have to pay, depending on which region in the state you are building that project. I will tell you, many public owners struggle with that. All contractors, in fact, this week we have put together, and we do it on a regular basis now for our members, we put together a prevailing wage all day long workshop. Why? Because people are trying to figure out how to do prevailing wage work. It is so complex, we have to help train them to see if they can participate in that market. It is a very complex business model that you have to do it correctly. If you don't do it correctly, there are substantial fines for not doing that correctly. So every single business impacted by either one of these bills would have to figure out how to do that. I just can't see why any business would take that on when what they're really trying to do is build their building so they can open their business and create jobs in the state of Oregon. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Miller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors in opposition to House Bill 2675 and 2677. And I think, I mean, one thing we can all agree on that we, you know, even the proponents of the bill is that we want to create more construction jobs in the state. I think where we disagree is that these bills will actually do that. I mean, I think it's important for the committee to understand the difference between the public funds aspect and the private funds in the development. And diminishing the economic development tools of the state to attract businesses. I think when you look at enterprise zones and you look at these tax credits, tax abatement programs that the state offers, that business has choices. They have choices normally in many states, and they can either come to Oregon or they can come to three or four other states that they're looking at. And that's what Oregon is trying to do, is attract these businesses. We all agree, again, the construction jobs are very important. So are those permanent jobs. But we're concerned that and again, for us, it's all about jobs and creating more jobs in Oregon. And anything that gets in the way from the state to actually attract those jobs into those enterprise zones or into the state, actually, we lose jobs if they choose another state. And we're concerned that these bills will do that. And with that, that'll end my remarks, Madam Chair. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions? Representative Fagan.
So the few enterprise zone projects that I'm aware of would be Facebook and Google building centers. Has there been any studies or is there data to show that they did hire local workers? Because I'm assuming those would be now covered prospectively, but those are the kind of projects that are not coming to a prevailing wage now. Did they hire Oregon workers? Did they hire workers from the local communities? And, you know, did they pay a living wage?
Chair Doherty, Representative Fagan, I do not have that level of information. The only thing I will say is in previous lives, I have utilized these tools, enterprise zones, abatements, et cetera. I was both a local and a state economic development official, and I worked in all kinds of communities, mostly in the metro area, but small communities. And I would just underscore that how it is viewed as one of the only tools that local communities have available to them. As to whether those particular companies use local workers, I just do not know. And I think probably the best thing would be maybe is to ask the Oregon Business Development Department and get that kind of specific information. I just don't have an answer.
I was going to comment, Madam Chair, Representative Fagan. I believe they did use Oregon workers. I think what they didn't have to do is probably go through all the public contracting code, public contracting law, to actually to do that. So, you know, we're happy to look into, you know, who they use. And actually, I think Mr. Molas may know that because I think he probably was involved in some of those projects. So, but I think, you know, obviously we regardless of whether we're for or against this bill, you know, we're all for using Oregon workers. And so I think that's one thing we can agree on as well.
Yeah. Chair Doherty and Representative Fagan, John Rakowitz again. We want our guys to go to work, our contractors to go to work. That's I represent Oregon and Southwest Washington. And so when they capture work, they're going to use their workforces. Their workforces are local. So we, again, that's a complete agreement. We want local workers working on these projects. I suspect there are times that that doesn't happen. But I think in the vast majority of cases, you have a competitive edge because you have the workforce right here. So you're able to do that. So that's how we view that issue.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I'm not so sure that this is a question or not, but I'll see if I can turn it into one. you know, you've made some comments that, I can understand your point of view, but still a little troubled with this whole discussion about economic development and, you know, how paying prevailing wages is an impediment to economic development. And, you know, from my standpoint, a major part of our economy is making sure people have living wages, have money in their pockets to go spend in our communities. And, you know, having prevailing wages seems like it enhances that that part of the economy. And so, you know, to say that, you know, that paying prevailing wages or considering these abatements and tax credits as part of that requirement changes everything. I don't know if you know when exactly the legislature previously declared that tax credits were not part of public funds, but I believe it was in 2009 that they actually made that change. And you know, I think this bill is going back to say, no, that was incorrect. Tax credits actually take money away from our general fund, or they take money away from the operational budgets of our cities and counties. And if it's the public policy of the state of Oregon that prevailing wages are an important part of our economy to make sure our workers can participate in the community, they can buy houses, they can go to the movies, and, you know, they can have health care, that's in the best interest of Oregon to make sure that happens. So I'm a little confused that the notion that prevailing wages will kill private investment is one thing on a particular project, but to say that prevailing wages impedes our economy is I'm having a hard time jumping to that conclusion that prevailing wages are a killer to our economy and to our economic investment when it's the public policy of the state of Oregon. When we invest our money, we want to make sure we have that added value of living wages. And I think that's the message behind these bills. And so I'm conflicted by how that is, compatible with the industry and our. And so can you just give me why does that have a conflict?
Do you want to respond to that? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I understand, you know, what you're saying, and I think what we're trying to understand and what we hear from the economic development experts, because they sit at the table with these businesses that they're trying to attract, they understand the choices that they have, which are not just Oregon. Again, it's multiple states in some instances, and they'll locate, and they're there to try to negotiate, and they're telling us, and you'll hear from them, that you know, where is the tipping point to where when you add public contracting law, prevailing wage, that they just say, you know what, Oregon's scratch it off the list. We're going to go to, you know, another state. And I think, you know, that's what we're hearing. So for us, it's a matter of, and I understand, you know, we're not saying that prevailing wage in any way, you know, it hurts our, you know, economy. What we're saying is, what is that tipping point that these businesses choose to go to another state, and then there, and therefore we don't get any jobs. So the construction jobs that we all represent are in another state. The permanent jobs that we could have had are in another state, and that's what we're trying to understand.
Okay. Any other quick questions? We have two more panels on this issue. So, quick question, Mr. Holvey.
I'm just troubled by that, because where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line? If that's the notion that that's a policy of Oregon, then, you know, we will continue to lower wages across the state with that kind of philosophy. And I mean, I guess that's the troubling part to me, is that if we just say, well, we don't care, it's more important for us to have this development and workers can work for minimum wage as long as we get this development. I mean, that's where ultimately that philosophy goes. And so, you know, I'm just troubled that we don't have a line there on public funds. Sorry for my comments there.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next panel, we have Sean Gillians, Steve Dahl, and Shannon Stady. And a few of you have written testimony, so if you could just summarize the testimony, because we do have it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be as brief as possible. For the record, Sean Gillians representing Oregon Economic Development Association, walking right up into Representative Holvey's question delightfully. We do represent a statewide organization representing folks who are on the front line of economic development activities in all communities throughout Oregon. The written testimony I submitted for you is from two of our members, Ron Fox from Southern Oregon and Roger Lee in Central Oregon. I think, Representative Holvey, one thing that seems to be getting lost here, and I'll kind of tee it off with this, is these enterprise zones are sponsored by local elected officials who are choosing to forego some property taxes in exchange for long-term benefit. And I think we're doing a disservice to our local elected officials if we somehow assume that they want to go a race to the bottom, that they don't care about their communities as well. They do. They can require certain things in their enterprise zone as they do these projects. What we're talking about here, and I think previous panelists have really highlighted, is redefining private projects to be public works. These bills do that. They take land that's private with a project that's private and redefine it as public works. And so I think when we look at the globally competitive environment that we're in, no one at the local level, the state level, wants to see that race to the bottom. At the same time, we do recognize that we're in that environment. I think you all have done a great job in the last couple of sessions of addressing some of the concerns with that. I would highlight Senate Bill 766 last time that kind of made it easier for permitting on industrial projects. But you all know we also face significant challenges in our land use system with the availability of industrial land. Much of our industrial land in the state of Oregon is in enterprise zones. And when you go, and I'll turn it over to the professionals who actually deal on the front line, when you go and tell a company, well, we might have some incentives for you, but your projects can be classified as a public work now. That is very detrimental in our efforts to try and bring in new businesses or expand. With that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the professionals, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions at the end.
Fine, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Shannon Stady, and I'm a business recruitment specialist with the City of Gresham. I'm also the Gresham Enterprise Zone co-manager and have been for about 7 years since its inception in March of 2006. I work directly with the companies that currently use it. All of them in the City of Gresham have been existing companies who've used the tool for an expansion within the city. But I also work on the recruitment side of things, so I often present it, as Sean said, to companies that are looking at the City of Gresham as a potential place to locate their facility. I'd like to give you kind of a quick background on the Gresham Enterprise Zone successes so far, and also some critical reasons why we think this bill will do grave harm to the Enterprise Zone program and the expansions it's helped Gresham realize over the last 7 years. Currently, we have 9 projects approved in the Gresham Enterprise Zone. Two of the most recent you may have heard of came just last week when our city council
approved. If you could just summarize, we have written testimony.
Okay, great. It's realized over $280 million in new investment in the city and over 600 family wage jobs. The Enterprise Zone was pretty key in helping companies expand during the recession. We also understand that our local companies compete globally, but they also compete internally with other facilities within their corporate structure. So making Gresham a place where they want to invest their business within their corporate structure, the Enterprise Zone has been a critical tool in that for several of our companies. It's also important to note that many of them are not big companies. Adding a BOLI requirement or management of those types of regulatory issues on the private sector simply just would be more than they could bear. In many instances, these companies, when they're creating or constructing new facilities, the facilities are often very specialized, very high-tech facilities. They require very specialized skills. Often, those companies that are expanding are required to select those companies based on their experience building that specific type of facility. So giving the companies another requirement which limits their ability to select those contractors would also be a significant challenge. So just in closing, we really feel that adding a prevailing wage component or requirement to the Enterprise Zone projects would essentially remove the tool from our toolbox.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Steve Dahl. I am past president of the Oregon Economic Development Association and currently in the Economic Development Director for the City of Grants Pass. Basically, I'll tell you a story of one of our current expansions. We have a $2.1 million investment in a timber products plant within our community. They're going to be hiring 20 people. The income tax received by those 20 people, assuming $18 an hour, minimum plus health and benefits, is going to be $853,632. The total tax break given to the company is going to be $879,429.60. If you put prevailing wage on top of this, you're looking at an added cost of building the building of $367,500, plus about 300 to 500 hours of extra time to make sure BOLI requirements are being followed through on. It's going to cost the company more money to do that. As you, by just requiring prevailing wage, you're cutting in half the tax benefit of the Enterprise Zone for this process. It actually costs the state nothing to do this. The local community has decided we want to make the investment in this direction. The state is the one who takes in that $853,000 in, for lack of a better term, profit in that situation. That's why I think putting prevailing wages into the enterprise zones would actually kill them, because it works so successfully in the country, and around the country it works well because it's simple. You do X, you receive Y. And that's what companies like when they look at companies and work where they're relocating. If they can understand that they do this, they get Y, and if it's successful for them, that's what they follow through on.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions? Representative Fagan?
Thank you. So I think this question is probably directed at the last two panelists. So I understand that we talk about two different kinds of jobs created through economic, these enterprise zones. You both touched on the, and I won't use the term permanent jobs because of Mr. Moles' testimony, but the people who work and operate whatever facility is built. So we're obviously talking today about the construction jobs, building whatever facility. So in your experience working with companies, how often do they use local Oregon construction workers? Not so setting aside the issue of the people who actually run the facility, construction workers, and pay them living wages, provide health benefits, etc.
It's my experience that a majority of the time, in fact, the only time I can't think of a construction project that was done by a local company that didn't use local labor. The one exception I can think of at the top of my head in Grants Pass is when Home Depot came in and built their new building. They had their contractors, they had come in outside the area and do that. But that wouldn't have affected anything in this bill at all, because that's a commercial industry. So most of my things, almost 100%, you know, at the time you're going to get that unless you get into some of these major projects.
Okay, Thank you.
If I might have
other questions. Go ahead.
Sorry, thank you. Chair Doherty, Representative Fagan, just to kind of follow up on Steve's comments, I think with our Gresham Enterprise Zone approved companies, they hire Oregon contractors as often as they can. I think we have a couple examples, like Steve mentioned, where they were very specialized types of construction projects where maybe the main contractor had experience building one for the company in a previous location, so they were selected as the main, but dozens of subcontractors, electrical, mechanical, and otherwise, were Oregon firms hired on that construction project.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
So, to Steve, if I heard you correctly, when a local company was using an enterprise zone to build a new facility, they used local Oregon workers. But when, for say, Home Depot came in, they didn't. And I think that is getting to part of the problem, is obviously a local company. But if the issue, as the previous panel said, is we're trying to attract and we're competing with other states, that, you know, we might not get the work. It sounds like when a large corporation like Home Depot came in, they did not use Oregon workers.
Okay, yeah, but one thing to remember is that 80% of, or around 80%, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, of all enterprise zones use is by local companies. Majority, I mean, it's that's where it's coming from. That's where the use is. And you're using, and where it comes into is when you get to have that specialized projects. You know, Home Depot is an example of that direction, because they basically have a form they have, and they basically go and produce it themselves. And that's when you get into that. But when you're looking for a industrial company to do that, you're going to be using local people that you know in that situation. And that's 80 80% of that group is going to be those contractors. Okay. And they use local people.
Okay, thank you. Quick questions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have to say, I'm well aware of what the enterprise zones have done for Gresham. It's my hometown, and I get it. But I'm also aware that the recent $300 million project doesn't require Boeing to add any jobs. Oh. It's a $12 million abatement to the city at a time when every citizen is paying $750 a month on their fees simply to keep public safety where it's at, which is unacceptable. We're looking at the public safety levy in 2014, and we currently borrowed two fire engines from Portland, and we got a third off of a Craigslist ad from Clackamas. And I honestly think that that's just unfortunate. I respect our mayor greatly as a personal friend. I respect our council. But we have to find the balancing point in this, because I want to support Boeing and what they're doing and other places too. But I've got to tell you that if we don't start looking at the revenue that we're losing in these contributions and the revenue needed to keep cities safe, I don't see where this is going to be a win-win for anybody.
Yeah, I think that was a comment, not a question.
That is exactly was a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any other quick questions? Okay, thank you very much. And last two, Mike Eliason, Scott Winkles. Closing act today, gentlemen. And as they say, we're running a little short on time, so.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Mike Eliason, Association of Oregon Counties. I've already submitted written testimony on both bills, so I'll be exceedingly brief, hopefully under a minute or so.
Thank you.
Currently, over 29 counties, up to 100 or more cities, numerous ports utilize enterprise zones as an economic development tool. Goals of local sponsorship are roughly twofold: generate construction jobs, and then full-time jobs, increase the assessed value of properties, in exchange for that, tax abatement or property tax credits would be granted for, in standard enterprise zones, 3 to 5 years, up to 15 years in rural enterprise zones. And by requiring prevailing wages on what are basically purely private construction projects, engaged by private employers, it serves as a significant disincentive in our mind by offsetting the savings, in some cases offsetting all of the savings generated by the property tax abatement. And we think that's probably a policy that we're not willing to support, therefore in opposition to both bills. It would also dramatically increase the involvement of local enterprise zone sponsors in what are essentially, again, private projects. And to Representative Thatcher's question from earlier, who then becomes the owner of the project? We've never really considered these to be public works projects. And so, frankly, the local government is not the owner of the project. It's the private the private companies engaged in the work. This would be, it would be unclear now if we're collecting certified payrolls, working with Boley. It creates a whole new layer that we are not really comfortable with at this time. So with that, I'll close right now. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Winkles?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I will be brief. I'm well practiced in testifying on this concept. I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind in looking at this bill is what is it we are trying to accomplish with these E-Zone projects. In order for a project to be eligible for an E-Zone designation, particularly in the rural areas, there has to be significant economic hardship. It has to be, the median income has to be below the county average. It has to have higher unemployment rates than the rest of the state. And so when my members, when the City League of Oregon Cities, when our city leaders go and agree to forego some of their property tax revenue, they're doing so to alleviate economic hardship and bring in some stability and some prosperity to an area where that's absent. And I think we need to focus on that aspect of this program. Additionally, the businesses that are located in these E-Zone projects are typically businesses that have high economic multiplier rates. So they have that bullseye, that money spreads out around the community. So they have, we've heard from previous panels the success we've had in using these programs. So there's a significant risk in changing this program in any way, and we need to be very cautious before we do so. One of the things we haven't heard from proponents in my memory of in previous panels or in previous sessions where this bill is similar comps this have been considered is what's the scope of the problem? Where has it happened where there has been a substandard rate paid? Where has it happened that there's been a out-of-state company that took a large portion of Oregon jobs where that wasn't appropriate? So that would be useful to know, and how we want to address that problem is what is the scope? What is it we're trying to fix? Where is that occurring? Additionally, the league believes adding a prevailing wage rate with the 5 years of legal liability, with the reporting requirements to a business, particularly a business that may already be paying a good wage to their construction workers, does that serve as a disincentive? The analogy I have consistently drawn on this concept is that of a job interview, where when you're hiring a person, the first blush of the first review of the resumes is you're looking to screen people out, the people who obviously aren't qualified, they have grammatical errors in their cover letters, these issues. And so does adding this requirement put us on the list where we get thrown out in the first pile? And I think that deserves further consideration and analysis. Additionally, I was somewhat concerned by some testimony in the earlier panel about suggesting that a project would be subject to 279, the public contracting code, a private project subjected to the contracting code. How would that work? What's the contracting board? How do you enforce this? Do you subject them to judicial review? Can they pick their own contractor? I think that would serve as a significant disincentive to a business looking to locate in the state of Oregon. With that, I will close. I think the league has been open in the past to conversations that do address the issue of non-Oregon, non-native hiring or Oregonian hiring in the past, and has made offers that we would be willing to entertain again. But we believe that this method simply is a risk, and we haven't heard haven't heard the scope of the actual problem we're trying to fix.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Mr. Kennemer, quickly.
Yes, I thought maybe I'd make more comment than a question, and that's as a former county commissioner, I know these enterprise zones were difficult decisions, and usually they were placed in an effort to move things along because they weren't moving as rapidly as we wanted. I have a long history of being a good supporter of prevailing wage, so this is a difficult one, and I just thought, we're... as I looked in my current area, my small towns, Canby, Oregon City, and Estacada are having a terrible time filling those enterprise zones. So, just...
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Say that.
Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little bit of a comment, and could be digging
quickly,
questions,
please.
But essentially we're competing with 49 other states for bringing industry or business or expanding some of our businesses here in the state, and this is one of the things that a lot of businesses look at. these companies, they hire people that buy houses, pay taxes on the property and everything else, even though we're giving up the industrial zone. Would these bills be something, in your mind, talking with businesses and talking with the cities and counties, that would hinder them from enticing businesses to locate in their cities?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, I am not an economic development professional, so I can tell you what I've heard from my members, and that
and if you could be brief.
When this was debated in 2009, a similar question was asked and to Tom Hughes, then mayor of Hillsborough, and he said, to his knowledge, the only other state that applied PV to this sort to abatements was Minnesota, and he could not recall being in competition with Minnesota for any projects. And that is probably the best answer to my recollection I could give you.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, we also do have testimony that has been submitted on House Bill 2675 from the City of Salem, which opposes, AOI, which opposes, Coos Curry, Douglas County Business Development Corporation opposes. On House Bill 2677, J.L. Wilson, from AOI opposes, and City of Beaverton opposes. With that, I close the hearings on both House Bill 2675 and 2677. And I open up a work session on... one thing, we're going to be carrying over the other bill. We have no one to testify, so we'll be carrying over 2545. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2061, if you could summarize as a reminder.
Well, Madam Chair, committee members, this is a bill that you heard twice before. It reduces from 60 days down to 30 days the time that an AMC has to pay their contract appraiser. The committee adopted earlier the -1 amendment that requires the appraiser be paid within 45 days. On the -1 amendment, there is no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, and LFO did not issue a statement.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kinnear.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2061 be reported out of committee with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Kinnear moves that House Bill 2061 be reported out of committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Thank
Quickly,
you, Madam
please.
Chair. This bill I'll be in no on today, dealing with appraisers. I've had them, one guy charged me $450, another one $750. I've paid it out of my own pocket. The banks have to contract with brokerage companies to do these things because they can't be seen as being too close. Sometimes it's out of their control on paying some of these, so there's a lot of things that happen in this industry, and it's getting so hard for people to get loans right now. I think this is another burden that's going to be in the way of doing it. I mean, after just going through the loan process and being here at the legislature and the way our income fluxes, it actually was a real headache for me to go through it. And this is just going to be one more headache that people have to deal with. So I will be a no on this bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Barton, quickly.
Madam Chair, I also plan to vote no. I have a constituent who is active in the appraisal management industry. He was very much opposed to the amendment. I was not here to speak against the amendment, and he's requested that I vote no. I take that very seriously, and I'm hoping that my no vote in turn will signal to my colleagues in the Senate that they should take a look at the 30-day versus 45-day.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, Brandon, please call the roll.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Matthews.
Representative Matthews votes aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
No.
Representative Widener.
No.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Barton.
No.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative Doherty.
Aye. What was the count on that?
6 ayes, 4 noes.
Okay, thank you. The motion passes. Representative Holbeek, would you like to carry it, please?
I'd love to. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, thank you. I close the work session on House Bill 2061 and open a work session on House Bill 2069. Jan, could you summarize, please?
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill authorizes DCBS to order the payment of temporary disability compensation for up to 21 months for certain injured workers in vocational training assistance. There are no amendments before you. There is no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Kammerer.
It's not amended, is that correct?
No amendments.
Yeah, okay. Then I would move House Bill 2069 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Kammerer moves House Bill 2069 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, please call the roll.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Weidner.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair, Representative Doherty.
Aye. And Mr. Kennemer, if you could carry that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. So I close the work session on House Bill 2069 and open a work session on House Bill 2403.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill modifies the process of purchasing scrap metal for recycling purposes, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments. This is a bill that a subject that has always been dealt with in the Judiciary Committee. The request is that the bill be moved to the House Judiciary Committee without recommendation. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2403 be reported out of committee without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, Representative Kennemer moves House Bill 2403 to report it out of committee without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, thank you. Two legislative, well, first of all, I will give a courtesy vote to move this bill out of committee, but I will be reserving the right to vote no on the floor depending on how other committees act on it. Mm-hmm. But we spent two sessions in this legislative body trying to put an end to the tweakers who are out there cutting up statues all over our state, including an icon in the city of Astoria. My PUDs could not even keep lines servicing customers because the tweakers were cutting down the electric lines. Hours and hours of work were put into stopping the illegal theft and sale of scrap metal. One of the most important provisions that we passed was not allowing people to sell scrap metal, which very well could be illegal, and receiving checks at a post office box. It's just a great way for tweakers to collect money on illegal metals. And I just think that the bill in its current form is a horrible step backwards.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Okay, seeing none, this is not a roll call vote. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection?
To moving it to Judiciary?
Pardon?
To moving it to Judiciary.
To moving it to Judiciary without recommendation. Okay, seeing no objection, the motion passes. And I close the work session on House Bill 2403. And one announcement is beginning March 4th, next Monday, we will begin meeting at 8 a.m. We gave you a month. So next, starting on Monday, 8 a.m., I adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor. Thank you for your attention.